This is Eric Lagata. I'm a features writer with the Columbus Dispatch. Today I'm talking with Bruce Koval, who is a children's book author. He will be appearing at Cover to Cover in Upper Arlington at 6:30 p.m. Thursday, January 24th. I know he's been writing books a while, so that's where I started with our conversation. So I know you've been at this for a long time. How long have you been writing children's books now?
Well, there's two parts to it, Eric. The first is writing them, and I started writing them far before I started publishing them. There was about a 10-year gap between deciding I wanted to be a writer and actually selling a book. My first book came out in 1978, so I've been publishing for 40 years now.
Wow. Yeah, that's a long time. That's great. And
I know. I can feel it in every bone of my body and getting older by the day.
Yeah. I guess tell me a little bit about what got you into writing yourself. What inspired you to do it? Were you an avid reader growing up, or what made you want to be a writer?
Yes, I was an avid reader, and that's part of it. But the seed goes back to my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Crandall, who had us write all year long, which was unusual back then. They didn't have you write much, but the only way you learn to write is by writing. You don't learn it by filling in blanks and surfing answers. You learn it by doing it. And she had us write all year long. I didn't do very well at it. We always had to write to her prompts. But at the end of the year, she gave us this wonderful assignment, which was simply, we're going to write a short story, and she didn't tell us what it had to be about. She just had us write. She gave us an extended period of time. One of the problems with writing is taught is kids are given this short period of time to write in school, but if you give them freedom to carry out of an idea, sometimes amazing things happen. And when I wrote that story, and she told us it would all be read out loud in class, so you knew you had an audience too, I had a great time and felt good about it. And every kid in the class did a good job. And that was the first time I thought I would like to be a writer, which is why my teacher's nearly as dedicated to her, because she's the one who said, tell me a story. Then it was indeed reading. The idea behind writing was I wanted to make the thing I loved, and what I loved was books. I was a passionate reader. And you start out by writing through the books that you loved, getting them out of your system. You've got to write enough to get through the books you loved and those authors and imitate them to find your own voice. That's when you become really a writer.
Yeah. And what were some of your favorite books or authors growing up?
Well, I spent a long time growing up. I'm finally there almost. Take me another year or two, I'll be grown up. Younger, I liked Hugh Lofting, the Dr. Doolittle books. I liked the Mary Poppins books. I loved the Mushroom Planet books by Eleanor Cameron. It was about the only science fiction available for kids at that time. When I hit middle school, I discovered Edgar Rice Burroughs, who created Tarzan, but the one I really loved was John Carter of Mars, the character. I was passionate about those books, and I think really that was what made me think, I want to do this. I want to write stuff that would excite somebody as much as these books excite me. And then, as my taste matured, it was Tolkien. So those are some of the primary influences.
Yeah. And you know, I know your books kind of touch on, you know, you've written over 100, I think, on your website, you said, and they range from fantasy to sci-fi. So, you know, where do you get your ideas? And, you know, I guess, why do you kind of enjoy exploring different genres?
Well, part of the reason to explore different genres is when you write as much as I have, you need to do different things to keep fresh. I don't want to be doing the same book or even the same style of book over and over again, which is why I've ranged from picture books to young adult novels, one adult novel, nonfiction, some mysteries, an historical novel, a contemporary YA. That helps keep you fresh and keep your voice fresh as a writer. Ideas, where do the ideas come from?
Yes.
That's actually the most common question writers get, and most of them eventually come up with a smart aleck answer. My smart aleck answer is also true. My ideas come from my idea folder. I have a thick folder in my desk just marked ideas. Of course, the question is, how do they get in there? And the answer is, I put them in there when they come to me. The human brain is an idea generating machine. I might generate a few more ideas than most people do because I've trained myself to think in terms of story. But we all have story ideas. If you get an idea and you think, oh, that'd be a cool story, someday I'll write it. If you don't write the idea down and save it, when someday comes, the idea is almost inevitably gone. So the trick is to put down the idea when it gets to you. I have both the physical file and the file I keep on my computer where I write down ideas as they come to me. You know, I do this for a living, but if I sit down at the desk in the morning and say, I got to write an idea, I got to write a story, I need an idea, the brain goes, yeah, right, fat chance. When you're doing something else, the ideas come to you. Also, they come from reading, especially nonfiction. If you were to examine any of the books in my personal library of history or science that I've read, and I've got lots of books that are there for when I need them, but I haven't read yet, you would find that I would have noted in this inside front cover and inside back cover pages and incidents that are possible seeds for stories or things that can be incorporated in stories. I also tear articles out of newspapers and magazines where I think, oh, that's a cool thing to happen. You could spin a story off from that, or that makes an interesting character idea. So you get them. It's like having what I call magpie brain. You look for sparkly objects, and you bring them back and put them in your nest. So they're there when you need them.
Yeah, that's great. I'm sure, like, a lot of writers, you know, can kind of relate to that as well. But I guess I'm kind of curious, you know, you write primarily for young adults, children. So what do you think makes you different than other children's book authors, or what do you think sets you apart?
That's a good question. question, and it's hard to answer it without, in any way, without sounding like, well, this is why I'm so wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, my mother told me not to say that, so... I think a couple of things happened. I hit, at a certain point, the zeitgeist. I matched the zeitgeist. I mentioned when I read the Mushroom Planet books as a kid, they were about the only science fiction available for kids in that grades 3, 4, 5, and 6 area. When I wrote My Teacher's an Alien, the general thought was that kids weren't interested in science fiction, kids of that age. After the book sold a million copies, people changed their minds about that. But it was a great deal of success in writing is luck and timing. And with that combination of funny and serious that marked that book and that series, my luck was that it was the right time for that, and it took off. I'd been writing, publishing at that point for about 12 years, 11 years, I think, and the book, My Teacher's Alien, made me an overnight sensation after 11 years. But it was the right book at the right time. I do have this combination of writing funny stuff that actually has deep moral context embedded in the text. I think that mixture of funny and seriousness and talking about the world and important things really appealed to young readers.
Yeah, and on that note, what do you hope that young readers take away from reading you? What kind of lessons do you hope to impart with them?
Well, let's start with the idea of lessons. If you start writing with the idea that I'm going to write to a lesson, what you would do is end up writing Sunday school papers. You must start with the idea, develop the idea to the best possible story, and if you are any kind of a human being, what you believe, what your moral values are, appear in the story as part of the process of working through what the characters are and what they believe and what they do. So it's not that I start with the idea of writing about a moral, it's that my moral sense comes into the story as characters are faced with different choices and decisions they must make. The essence of a story is characters being forced to make decisions. And the tougher the decision and the more morally difficult it is, then the more interesting the story becomes.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, you've written a lot of books, and a lot of them are for young readers. So what do you enjoy about writing books for young readers, and why is that something that's important to you?
The adult world has become very cynical. And I am not, I've managed to resist being cynical. There are things that are happening these days that make me really totter towards cynicism, but basically I'm very, I would say, sunny of heart. And I like writing for kids because that's okay there. The adult literary world sort of looks down on optimistic, upbeat stuff, but I'm an optimistic, upbeat person, so my place is in the world of kids' books. Not only that, writing for kids is the place where you can have the most impact. If you ask people what book changed their life, they will almost always answer with a book that they read as a young person. Maybe not in 4, 5, 6, where I mostly work in my work. Maybe in middle school, maybe even in high school. But it's almost always a book they read when they were young. I have a file I keep called To Look At on Bad Days, because we all have bad days, and if you're in the writing business, you're definitely going to have some bad days. And it's letters I've received over the years that really give me faith that what I'm doing makes a difference. One of my favorites was a young person went to me and said, "My mother blames you for my politics." And I thought, well, score.
That's great. Do you keep, you know, most of the letters you get and kind of look through them like that?
Well, I couldn't really keep most of the letters I get. When you were reading me, Eric, my career was at its peak. And I know there's waves and crests and troughs in a career, so I don't worry about not being sort of selling the way I did back then. But at that point, I was getting about 3,000 letters a year. And you really can't keep all those and sift through them. And a lot of times, they're very much similar.
Yeah.
It's fine. Again, kids write about the same things. But every once in a while, something's really extraordinary or moving, and I do save it. One of the things that startled me and disturbed me is that now that sort of my first generation of readers, when I was really riding high, are adults. They write to me now to tell me what the books meant to them as kids, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Except that I have a disturbing number of letters that start out or somewhere in the middle veer toward, I had a horrible childhood. I was an abused childhood. I was a neglected child. And in your stories of fantasy, I found refuge. I would read them over and over again, and in my mind, go to live in those worlds that you were creating. And that gives me, one, this feeling of, God, I've done something wonderful with these kids, but two, reinforces how hard kids' lives can be.
Yeah, and it's almost like you say, finding refuge in kind of that fictional world and being able to escape from their hardships for a while. Have you found, like, I know, like, now we're kind of in, like, the digital age and lots of things to distract kids, and they, you know, I wonder if they're not reading as much, but have you found, like, do kids, you know, from your experience, are kids still reading a lot, and what's that like right now?
I do believe kids are still reading a lot. You know, they've always had distractions. Well, let's not say always, but from the time of television on, there's been a struggle for the attention of children, and the kids who are readers still read. I mean, there's a certain segment of kids who are just passionate readers. The interesting thing is they like to spend time on their devices and with screens, but they don't like to do their reading of books there. We anticipated in the field, publishing as a whole, that there'd be a surge in ebooks for kids in sort of my target market. market, that intermediate third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade market, when parents started to get new devices, new e-readers, and pass their e-books readers down to their kids. That didn't happen, because it turns out that kids at that level still like having a real book, holding a real book, reading from a print book.
Yeah, I can relate to that too. I'd like to read, and I tried to do the ebook thing for, you know, a short time a few years ago, and I just didn't like it as much as holding a paper copy in my hands. There's just something about that, I think.
Well, that remains definitely true for the middle school kids. High school kids very much seem to be reading, the passionate young adult readers, reading on their devices. I mean, print is still very important there too, but for the middle school kids, for the intermediate school kids, they like having that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you write a lot about aliens. You mentioned my teacher's an alien. I have a signed copy of Space Brat from you. and I noticed on your website, one of the frequently asked questions was about whether or not you've ever been abducted yourself. What could you say about that?
I'm not allowed to speak about that.
Okay, moving on. But on a serious note, you do write a lot about aliens. Why is that? Have you always kind of been intrigued by extraterrestrial life?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, I have always been intrigued by extraterrestrial life. My next door neighbor and I, when we were kids, I'd say probably 8 or 9, used to play and imagine. We had these imaginary alien friends. And I think they really spun off from a spin-off of a comic book. Little Lulu had a friend named Tubby, and there was this series of stories they appeared off and on where he met these little alien characters. And we loved those stories, and we sort of incorporated it into our imaginative play. And then when I started reading science fiction as I got a little older, again, the concept of life on other planets. And then I was actually invited to write my breakthrough book, My Teacher's an Alien. I'd written Space Bat before that, but it didn't get published right away. If we can get back to that, I'll tell you a funny story about that.
Okay.
What I realized when I was writing My Teacher's an Alien was that writing aliens is a great way to do social commentary. Now, again, I didn't start out with this in mind. As I said, you don't start out with the lesson in mind. But I realized as I was working on it that it let me talk about things that were important to me. For this reason, aliens can view us from the outside. When you're stuck in your own mess, you don't sometimes see what you're doing or what is obvious to somebody who's outside. I'm sure you've had this experience with friends, or friends have had it with you. Well, you can see your friend making big mistakes, but they can't see it because they're too deep inside of it. And writing from the alien's point of view, or having the aliens talk from their point of view, let me talk about a lot of things that were important to me. It lets you do social commentary because they view it from the outside. And that helps kids view things that we're doing from the outside. But that's also, it's a great source for comedy. You know, there's a basic aspect of comedy, or one strand of comedy is fish out of water, going way back to the Beverly Hillbillies. You take somebody who has a very specific kind of way of being and throw them in an entirely different kind of milieu and watch people bounce off each other as they misunderstand each other. So you can get great comedy out of doing aliens because they look at things and see things in a different way than we do. And from that comic distress can also come understanding. So it gives you a great way to talk about the world and what you believe about it. A kid asked me when I was speaking in school the other day how many alien books I had done, and I had to stop and count on my fingers. But out of the 100 books, about 25 of them center on aliens.
Wow. Yeah. So about 25%.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you too about, I saw on your website, on your biography, you said you worked as a toy maker, gravedigger, cookware salesman, assembly line worker, all before becoming a full-time writer. Did those experiences shape your writing at all? Have you ever drawn on those experiences in your work or anything? Or?
Well, yeah, being a gravedigger was great.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for one thing, it's, you know, you have these writer biographies that almost always list this thing, the stuff you've done. And gravedigger is just killer to have on it, so to speak, because kids love that when it comes up. But also, I actually wrote a book where some kids had to dig up a grave, and I thought, yeah, I know the physics of this, I know the biology, I know the body work of this. So yeah, that did help me out. I also used to get great ideas when I was digging graves. You asked about ideas earlier. One thing I've learned is that when I'm doing something that takes the top part of the mind, the less creative conscious mind, out of the way, and you focus on that, then the under part of your brain, the subconscious mind, feels more free to send up ideas. I used to work on the assembly line of the IBM when I was in my 20s, and it was piecework, it was repetitive assembly line work, and once I got in the rhythm, my hands could operate and do the job, but my brain was free to range wide, and I would just think of ideas, because it was almost like being in trance. I could work, but also had the brain generating ideas. The job that had the most impact on my writing, though, was being an elementary school teacher. The 7 years I spent in the classroom were like graduate work in how to write for kids, because I was with kids every day, had to learn how kids were operating, how they were thinking, how I could figure out what they were thinking to try to help them become better people or help them deal with behavioral issues they were having.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I read that you were also a teacher. I imagine, yeah, that's exactly. You're working with your future audience, basically. So.
Exactly. Plus, I use some of those kids in books as characters.
Yeah. And I know you work a lot with your wife, Catherine. What kind of things do you two work on together, and what's kind of her role in the creative process?
Well, Kathy, there's a couple of beasts to that answer. One, Kathy was an illustrator. She's not now because she had a thyroid problem that made her hand shake so much that she could no longer draw the tight lines she used to. So she's now a writer. She's got two books coming out next year. Who knew?
Mm-hmm.
But when we were working together, she was provided a great deal of inspiration by the things she would draw. Our very first book together, and we started working together when I was 19 and she was 17, so it's been a long partnership. We didn't sell it until I was like 27, so again, that was a long trail. But our first published book was a collaboration, a picture book called The Foolish Giant, which we'll have at the bookstore, by the way, where she had drawn a picture because I was babbling on about, I was taking a graduate class in writing for kids, and she would have been monitoring it, auditing it, except that we had a brand new baby. So I'd come home and I can just babble on about things we were doing in this class, and I tend to babble, and she tends to be very quiet and calm, and she was just drawing while I was talking and turned it on this sketch she'd made of a giant who'd stepped on a fence and was being yelled at by a little tiny farmer, and she said, write me a story about him. And that became The Foolish Giant, our first book. So you can see she's a very important inspiration to me in that way. When I had sold the concept for the book Aliens Ate My Homework, in my head there were five aliens, all from the same planet, they all pretty much looked alike. But she didn't know that was, she just knew there were five aliens, and she started drawing all different kinds of aliens. We had this brainstorming session, which is something we used to do, and we thought of these, based on her sketches, these bizarre traits and these funny things. We would used to make each other laugh so much we'd fall off the chairs getting up to this stuff. But then she drew portraits of the five aliens, and I hung them up around my office as I was writing. So the aliens are, and their personalities are profoundly affected and shaped by the drawings and the brainstorming session that we had.
Oh, that's great. So is she behind like a lot of the artwork for your books, like the cover?
She illustrated, let's see, about 20 of the books she illustrated.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And I know you have three children together. Did any of them catch the writer's bug?
No, that made me sad. Our oldest is a brilliant writer, but I think he just felt he didn't want to do what his father did. Our second is also a brilliant writer, but she has what many people have, and I find this in my teaching, uncertainty about her skill as a writer. And there is that problem of, oh, can I do what Dad did? Can I live up to Dad? And that's been a very sad thing for me, that she doesn't feel more confident. But I'm still working on her. She's trying to get her right. And I always would like to write, so maybe something happened there.
Yeah, that's great. What's your favorite book you've ever written, and why?
Why don't you ask me next which of my children I love the most and why? You know, it's like your mother says, who do you love most? Mom, me or my sister? And she says, oh, I love you both in different ways, dude. What a stupid answer. The right answer is I love you the most, but my mother never said it.
Yeah, it might be a tough question.
Yeah, actually, I could give you different reasons to like different books.
Yeah.
I could say my teacher's an alien because it made the most money. Good. I could say Jeremy Thatcher, Dragon Hatchet, because if I had to guess, which would be around 25 years after I'm pushing up daisies, that's the one I put my money on. But I can actually give you a favorite, if you give me time to give you a preview to why that is. And the book is called Sarah's Unicorn. It was our second book. And the reason I would list it as a favorite is because kids always ask you this question as part of the Q&A in the assembly. When you start to write a book, you have something in your head you're trying to create that you're better than you're actually capable of accomplishing. And the reason is, you might actually do better than you really feel you're capable of. If you start to write a book and you come into it trying to do less than you're capable of, and this happens when people are commissioned to write books. You know, I have worked with packagers who put together book packages, and if you're, for example, asked to write a Nancy Drew book, they don't want you to put on something that shows your best stuff off. They want it to be just like every other book in the series. Writing for TV series can be like that. So you should be trying, when you're doing your own books, to do better than you think you're capable of. And I've never, ever written a book out of, in 40 years, 100-plus published books, I've never written a book as good as the one that was in my head. But Sarah's Unicorn comes closest to the one that was in my head. And so I love it for that reason.
Hmm.
Now, I've been saying that for about, I don't know, 20, 25 years. About 10 years ago, something else happened. And this is a true story. There was a carjacking in Florida. This woman's getting ready to drive her kids to school. She's got an 8-year-old little girl and a 6-year-old little boy in the backseat of the car. They're in the driveway, the car's running. They realize they've left something at the house. Mom says, stay here, I'll be right back. She runs up to get it. While she's at the house, this bad guy comes running across the lawn, jumps in the car behind the driver's seat, behind the steering wheel. Mother sees it, comes running back down, but she's too late. He hits the gas, and he's now zooming down the street. She's watching him zooming down the street with the two kids in the back seat. The little girl in the back seat takes her vibrator book and starts beating him up the head with it from the back seat. Wham, wham, stop it, you bad guy. Wham, wham. And the guy gets so upset but he lets the two kids out, accepts the kindness of the two kids out. And the book he was beating him over the head with was Sarah's Unicorn. So
oh,
my
wow.
books save lives.
That's awesome. That's a great story. Wow.
I found out because I started getting these messages from friends in Florida saying, your books are all over the news. And I thought, oh, God, am I being censored again? But then I found the story, and it was that story. And Ellen DeGeneres had the mom and the daughter on her show a few days later to talk about it.
Wow, that's fascinating. I never heard about that. When was that, you said? It was a few years ago?
Oh, it's got to be 10 years ago.
10 years ago. And what is Sarah's Unicorn about? I've never heard of that one.
It's a picture book. It was our second picture book.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we wrote it. Oh, this is, I told you, I would tell you why Space Brat wasn't published when I first wrote it. It took a number of years for it to come out after I became known as the alien guy. We had done it, what we thought would be our second picture book. So the alien thing does go back to, like, very early in the career. I had been driving to school as a teacher. And in my head, this is the subconscious mind thing going on, I heard Space Brat. And I thought, wow, that's a book I got to write. So I'd done this picture book text about Blork, this kid who was Space Brat. And Kathy had done a couple of pictures. And we sent it to our editor. This was after The Foolish Giant. So this was back in 1977, actually, after we'd sold The Foolish Giant. And the editor wrote back, and the year is important when you hear this rejection letter. She said, I don't think children will be interested in a noseless green humanoid from outer space. This was about 4 years before E.T., a noseless brown humanoid from outer space, became the biggest money-making film of all time at that point. And besides, she said, 1977, this Star Wars craze will never last. That is a rejection letter for the ages.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow.
So we were really feeling really cranky about that. And Kathy said to me, write me a book about a little girl who's got a little boy who's got a unicorn. I said, well, actually, it's, you know, mythically, it's little girls. Unicorns come to young maidens in the wood. But I got up the next morning and feeling really cranky about this rejection, I sat down and wrote Sarah's Unicorn in about an hour, which sounds really easy until I tell you I also wrote 50 more drafts before I got the one that's been published. But that's how I became both the alien guy and the unicorn guy.
That's funny. Wow, I can't believe I totally misjudged Star Wars' impact.
Yeah, I kept, because I never threw anything away, so I kept the Space Brat, and about 10 years later, I rewrote it in the form that you read, and it was sent around several places, and people thought it was too weird, but I kept it. And my kids kept saying, Dad, what about Space Brat? Because they loved it. So I knew it was, and this is so typical in our business, we booked the kids' response to that adults didn't get. And after having been rejected several times and sitting my files, and after my teacher knew it became such a big hit, I sent it to my editor for that series. And after all those rejections, she bought it overnight for the biggest advance I'd ever gotten. So that's why I tell people, you never throw this stuff away. You just got to find the right time and place for it.
Yeah, that's a great lesson. Are you working on anything right now or anything in the works?
Actually, I am right now, right at the point, and this is because you're asking this right now, I am trying to decide what I'll be working on right now, because on Friday, I send in my most recent book to the editor. Now, I need to tell you about that because it goes back to the same about time and place. The book is called The Wind Lord's Horn. And I started writing it in 1970. And I'd finished it, I think, in 1972 or 1973. And it is now 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a contract for it and what I hope is the final working draft. I just don't let go of stuff.
Yeah. Wow. That's a long time to hold on to that.
Yeah. Old dog.
Well, that's great. What's the premise behind that book?
The premise is, and it's funny because here we are, 2018, an ecological disaster, but with a fantasy setting. The wind has died, stopped, dead, cold. There's no wind anywhere on the planet. The scientists are baffled, and the main character, Hurricane Smith, his mom is hospitalized because of lung congestion because the air is getting so bad and she has an asthmatic kind of problem. He's alone, and this old man comes to him who claims to be Zephon, the Lord of the Winds. He explains that he, with his wind horn, has been making the wind for all the world forever. But this horn has been stolen, and he's magically blocked from sensing it. But because he saved a hurricane one night during a bad storm, he calmed the winds when the house had blown off over them, that the wind horn magic had sunk in him, and he believes that hurricane can help him track thief of the horn. And they go off on this adventure that spans several worlds, trying to find where the horn has been and why it was stolen, what's going on there.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And I think that kind of goes back to what you were saying about right time, right place, you know, for a book. And it sounds like this is one you've been holding on to for a while. But now a book that kind of has that, you know, ecological climate change theme is really relevant right now.
Yeah, it is. It was relatively relevant at the time. It's just gotten more and more relevant as we continue to screw up the world. So.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, Bruce, I really appreciate you taking some time with me this morning. I really have enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, well, I have too, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you again, and look forward to having you in Columbus.
I am looking forward to making the visit.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you, Bruce. You have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, you too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.